to my bag and pulled out a foil package. I felt four heavy cylindrical objects inside as I stuffed the package through the gaping hole in the ceiling. I positioned them just by the edge, easy for me to reach in a hurry. Then I stooped down for the light fitting and worked as quickly as I could to reposition the screws. It was depressing to think I'd have to go through this all again on the night of the banquet. The buzzer vibrated in my pocket just as I had one screw left. Ah, screw you, Lee. I'm almost done. I had the screw at just the right angle. If I let go, I'd have to start this one again, and I was running dangerously low on time. I spent the next minute refining the angle before leaping down to the floor and tucking the chair beneath the table where I'd found it. The pager had vibrated twice more since then. When I pulled out the device from my pocket and checked it, my blood ran cold. Get out of the lab! My heart in my throat, I grabbed the bag and bolted for the door. Out of the lab? What does that even mean? Out of this particular lab or out of the building? But as I reached within 10 feet of the exit, I froze. Footsteps sounded outside. I should have checked the pager the second Lee sent the first message. It was too late now. I was trapped. I looked frantically around the room for a hiding place. I had no time to even consider whether diving beneath the table closest to me would be the best option. A few seconds after I'd slid beneath the furniture, the door glided open. Footsteps entered. I clasped a palm over my mouth, trying to stifle my breathing. A man in corduroy pants walked past my table, continuing down the aisle. He was dragging behind him a suction cleaner. Why hadn't Lee known about this? I was trusting him blindly. He was supposed to have thought through all of this. I'm putting my life in that man's hands. The intruder walked to the end of the aisle and started up the machine. The room filled with white noise. My fingers unsteady, I reached for my pager and punched in a message. Stuck inside. What now? I stared down tensely at the device after sending it. Come on, man. Lee's reply arrived 40 seconds later. Stay where you are. What? For how long? The cleaner was moving slowly but steadily toward my end of the room. He was cleaning thoroughly, too, making sure that he got every last bit of dirt out from underneath the tables. He was going to find me. Just as I was contemplating darting beneath a different table, one further away that would hopefully buy me some more time, the door opened, and in stepped a second cleaner, also with a suction machine. He started cleaning much closer to me. At the rate he was sweeping across the floor, he was going to reach me in less than a minute. Trapped, I paged. I clutched the device, waiting with bated breath for Lee's response. It wasn't coming. The second cleaner arrived within 5 feet, then four, then three, then the suction broom took its first swipe beneath my table, missing my left foot by a fraction. Clutching the bag, I spread myself as flat against the wall as I could, leaving as little of me touching the ground as possible. But it wasn't going to be enough. The machine moved forward again, this time aimed directly at my feet. Like a rabbit caught in the headlights, I closed my eyes, steeling myself for the impact, while hoping against hope that he might mistake me for a table leg. The broom hit me, but as it did, an alarm rang out, so loud it felt like my eardrums would split. Although the broom had touched me, the guy became too distracted to check what he'd hit. He dropped the machine, and so did his colleague. The two of them rushed out of the room. I took a moment to steady my breathing, drawing in a long, quiet breath. Then I moved forward and peered out from under the table. Now I needed to get out while I could, making sure that my mustache, beard, and hair were still on straight, just in case I got spotted outside. I left my spot beneath the table and headed for the door. But for the second time, it opened before I could reach it. There hadn't even been footsteps to warn me. I didn't even have time to throw myself under a table. It was Lee, and I had never been happier to see that man. He scanned the lab wide-eyed before taking my arm and pulling me out of the room. The corridor was empty, but he did not head back to the same stairwell that I had come up. Instead, we moved in the opposite direction down another hallway before reaching a red door. As Lee opened it, a damp breeze swiped at my face. It led outside to a narrow metal staircase scaling the back wall of the building. Lee pulled me outside into the rain, and we clambered down the steps as fast as we dared. Then, as we kept close to the wall and pulled on our raincoats, Lee led me back to the parking lot. Reaching the car, he opened the front passenger door. I collapsed inside, stowing the bag beneath my knees. I expected Lee to take a seat next to me and immediately drive off. But instead, he whispered, "I'll be back in a minute. I have to go back in and restart the cameras." He swept back to the building and through the glass doors. He didn't take long. 3 minutes later, he was back in the car and we drove toward the parking lot exit. We were both silent until we were firmly outside of the gate and speeding back toward home. "What happened?" the two of us demanded at once. "I'm sorry," Lee replied first. "The cleaners were not due in today. They were supposed to come tomorrow. A change in the schedule was obviously made, and whoever was responsible for it forgot to mark it in the works calendar. It couldn't have been prevented." He looked at me sideways. "Did you pull it off?" "Yes," I huffed. "It's done." Lee nodded, relief washing over his face. "Good girl." Chapter 24. After we returned to Lee's house, he didn't have anything for me to do for the rest of the day, but he preferred not to call Vigo. My voice was too deep to see him anyway. He suggested that I see him again tomorrow, when my main priority would be to figure out whether his schedule would be changing on the night of the banquet. Lee drove me to the head office in the morning and took me upstairs to Vigo's floor. "Come in," came a familiar grunt as Lee knocked. Lee pushed open the door, and the two of us stepped inside. Vigo sat behind his wide desk wearing a dark green T-shirt, his coat hanging from the back of his chair. A small pile of papers lay in front of him. "All right, Vigo?" Lee asked pleasantly. Vigo nodded, his eyes moving to me. "Violet mentioned the contract. Congratulations." "Thanks," Vigo replied, monotone. "Okay, I'd better head off. See the two of you later." Lee turned to me and leaned down to peck me on the cheek before leaving the room. The second kiss he'd laid on me, the first he had laid in public. Trying not to get too caught up in mulling over Lee's weirdness, I approached Vigo's desk. As our eyes met, a smile spread across both of our faces. I took a seat opposite him. "How was your day yesterday?" I asked him. He shrugged. "Uneventful. Yours?" I couldn't quite bring myself to say uneventful, so instead I replied, "Fine. Lee had the whole day free and wanted us to spend it together." Vigo nodded stiffly, averting his eyes to the table. "Mr. Sands must have called you, right?" I said.
"He did."
"Well?"
"They want the fight to be sooner than I had expected. Next week."
"Next week? Which day?"
"Saturday."
The banquet was to be held the Wednesday after. I suppose that meant Vigo's schedule would remain the same, if the fight was to be over days before. Any changes to his training routine would, in theory, take place prior. "Are you able to get any extra time off from your warden duties to train? It's so soon."
"No extra time off above my yearly allowance," he replied. "I'll figure it out."
"Who are you up against?" I asked.
"They've decided they want to escalate me straight to Cruz."
"Seriously?"
"Yep," he said, rubbing his jaw.
"Are you nervous?"
He shrugged again. I guess that meant no.
"So what's your plan for today? Warden duties until evening?"
"No. I've got the second half of today free. I plan to train a little, but I'll be heading back home. I think your husband is expecting that I take you with me and then drop you at your house at the end of his workday."
"Okay," I said.
This would be the first time I'd be alone with Vigo in his house, so far away from other people. I wondered if it might feel awkward.
Vigo returned his focus to his papers, but said,
"By the way, you might be interested to know that the man we reported, or rather you reported, at number 32 will be questioned today. Good, I muttered. I'd done my part. Now I had to hope justice got served.
Vigo finished leafing through the papers in front of him before tucking them into a drawer. We spent the rest of the morning outside. The rains of yesterday had given way to a bright blue sky. Vigo had to make another visit to the arms store for a meeting with the manager, which took up a good part of the morning before returning to head office. He led me to a large conference room on the ground floor, where he met with about 50 other wardens, all of them working under him, apparently. I sat in the chair by a corner, a little separated from the men. I didn't want to cause waves by taking a seat right among them. Vigo had three things on his agenda. First, he informed them of new weapons that the force was bringing in, as well as giving them a demonstration. Next, he spoke about new security protocols to be instigated near Thicket's Bridge, apparently a bridge located somewhere in the mountains that connected a route to Porticue. And finally, he asked for an update on what was happening regarding the man who had escaped from the recent kidnapping incident, the man I hadn't managed to catch. There were no updates in that regard. Apparently, he had escaped, well and truly. After the meeting, everybody piled out of the conference room and headed to the canteen for lunch. Vigo and I accompanied them. As we collected trays and served ourselves a hot meal, I felt eyes watching me. Nobody looked directly at me for more than a few seconds, but I could tell the men were wondering who I was exactly and why I was hanging around with their chief. After we'd eaten, we left the building and headed to Vigo's motorcycle. Soon we were speeding toward his side of the mountains. We hit an unexpected spell of traffic along the way. I thought that maybe another accident had taken place and was clogging up all the roads again, just like the other night. But that didn't appear to be the case here. I strained my neck to see through the line of honking vehicles.
Damn, Vigo murmured.
What?
I forgot it was today.
Forgot what was today? I squeezed his waist, pressing him for an answer.
King Maxon is making an appearance just up the road.
You see that gold sedan? Yeah, just about. A shiny golden vehicle was parked up near the sidewalk to our left.
That's the King's. It's the inauguration of a new hospital. I'm off duty now, otherwise I'd be there making sure things ran smoothly.
A new hospital?
They say it's going to be the most technologically advanced we've ever had in Patras, Vigo said.
Lots of new, technological stuff going on around here, I commented.
Yeah, Vigo said, and there will be a lot more to follow in the coming months. Don't ask me for details. I don't make a habit of reading the papers.
Or watching the news or listening to the radio, if his cabin was anything to go by. I guessed life was a lot quieter that way. More peaceful without the constant bombardment of headlines. I had lived that way for a lot of my life, too. Not that I'd had much of a choice in recent years, being stuck in detention centers. It wasn't exactly a priority there to keep the girls informed of current events. I inhaled deeply as we approached the foothills, once again relishing the crisp, pure air.
"Do you always train by yourself?"
I asked.
"Of course not. There are guys I spar with in the gym. But sometimes it's good to be out in the open."
I agreed. Ascending higher and higher, I finally caught sight of Vigo's cabin as we traveled the last stretch of road. This was the first time I had seen it in daylight. It was really small for a guy like Vigo. I wondered if he ever felt claustrophobic. Then again, if he did, he could sit out in the open, which I guessed was what the chair on his porch was for. After disembarking and parking his motorcycle, he led me up the steps to the wooden platform that ran around the cabin and opened the door.
"Come in if you want," he told me, already heading toward his bedroom. "I need to change."
Closing the door politely behind me, I headed to the sitting room. It looked the same as the night I'd last visited. Even the ointment and bandages were in the same place, although the hearth was not ablaze. I was left to look out of the window, down at the bustling city, for a couple of minutes before Vigo returned barefoot, sporting a loose pair of pants
and a looser black shirt that revealed a flash of his chest.
"Want some in a drink?" he asked. "I only have water."
"I'm okay for now." We returned outside, and I followed him around to the back of the cabin, where he had a sprawling backyard. Most of it was overgrown, but there was a stretch in the center where the grass had been kept trimmed. A makeshift log shelter stood by its border. Beneath it was various exercise equipment, weights, benches, and other strength training gear I couldn't put a name to. The view from this side of the house took me by surprise. Vigo's home being on a high plateau, it afforded a view of the other side of this mountain. The cliffs and peaks dipped down into a lush valley, through which ran a glittering river, and on the other side, more regal mountain ranges sprawled out for as far as I could see. Some peaks were so high, I couldn't even see their tips. Low clouds hung over them in an otherwise spotless sky. Vigo's view was unique. Cityscape on the one side, wilderness on the other. He caught me staring in awe.
"So deeper into these mountains is where you plan to buy land, once you quit being a warden?" I asked him.
"Not too deep, but deeper."
I squinted, trying to gauge how far my vision would stretch into the distance.
"What's too deep?"
"Certainly no further than Thicket's Bridge."
"Wherever that was." Vigo moved over to the log shelter and picked up some weights. I knelt on the grass as he began to warm up, my attention half on him, half on the view that was still taking my breath away. So far, things didn't feel awkward. And I suspected that wouldn't change. He was the same man as he was down in the city, just with a bit more breathing space. Vigo worked out for the next hour and then retreated into the cabin for water. He brought out a steel jug and two glasses.
"Hope I'm not distracting you by being here," I told him, accepting a glass.
"No," he said, dropping down on the grass next to me. "I plan to give myself a bit of a break today anyway. Still some days to go before the fight. And I know Cruz's style. Seen it many times before."
He removed his shirt, wiping the sweat from his face, chest, and neck. I stood up and wandered over to his equipment, testing the weight of his dumbbells. They were heavy. Very heavy. I played with a few other items before turning to face him. He was watching me. I slipped my hands into my pockets, kicking at the ground casually as I asked, "Would you teach me a thing or two about what you know?"
"Teach you what, exactly?"
"I don't know, some punching and blocking tips, some grappling techniques. You're like a snake when you get a hold of someone." He glanced toward the front of his cabin, as if to check no one was watching.
"Okay." Putting down his glass, he strode over to me. "Let's start with some blocks. Say I go to punch you like this." He moves his fist toward me in slow motion. "How would you block it?"
I swiped it aside with a swift chop of my right forearm. Not the most elegant move, but it usually did the trick.
"Okay," Vigo said, "and what about like this?"
He came in with a slow, round hook. Since there was enough space between us, I ducked down and went for his knees. "Now I would floor you," I said, hooking the back of my ankles against the back of his.
"Try it," he said.
I jerked my ankles forward, causing him to lose balance. He caught his fall expertly with his rigid arms and palms spread out.
"And now," he said, sitting up and twisting me around so that my back was against his chest, "if I held you in this choke..."
He locked one arm around my neck, the other fastening my arms behind my back.
"How would you get out?"
Good question. This was difficult because neither of us was standing. I couldn't knock him to the ground like I had done back in his changing room when he'd held me from behind. I tried to maneuver my legs to distance myself and loosen his grip on me, but I failed. I realized that I actually did not know, or remember, how to get out of this.
"What's the answer?" I asked.
"What if I told you the answer is there's no way out of this one?"
"I'd call bull," he chuckled.
"Then get out of it." His challenge got my creative juices flowing. I realized what I would do. My knees were touching the ground, which meant that I had leverage. Due to the nature of his hold, his face wasn't far from the back of my head. I would jerk my body upward suddenly, catching him with a headbutt strong enough to weaken his grip on me for a few seconds. Then I'd slither out. Obviously, I wasn't going to actually do that now. I didn't want to give Vigo a bloody nose before his fight, so I just explained it to him.
That might have worked, he said. But I guess we'll never know. Now that you've told me your idea, I'll be sure to watch the back of your head.
Still, his grip remained on me.
Hey, come on, I said, grinning.
There is another way out of this, though, he said. At least one other way that wouldn't require you to smash my face in. Figure it out.
Vigo was a hard taskmaster, but I liked it. Another idea came to me, and this time I acted instantly. Using my knees, I shoved all my weight to the right as I leaned backward. The mix of movement and direction was enough to rock Vigo's balance. We both toppled to our sides on the grass. As we made contact with the ground, there was a second where Vigo's hold loosened on my arms. I managed to slide them out in front of me and then break his hold on my neck enough for me to squirm and twist until I was facing him, our noses inches apart. I froze, realizing just how close we'd come to each other. Closer than we'd ever been. I paused for a few seconds to take in the details of his eyes, his dark lashes, every hue of green in his irises, and the way they seemed to gleam as he looked back at me. Then, experiencing a flush of bashfulness, I switched back into fighting mode. Curving my right arm around him, I shoved myself further upward until my right shoulder dug into his neck, while I flattened his left arm beneath me. His right arm was still free, but I kept my head pressed close to his, which made it tougher for him to gain control of me. Of course, if he was actually fighting with me, he would have made things a lot more difficult. But as I released him and we both sat up, there was still a shine to his eyes. He seemed pleased. We spent the next few hours discussing techniques and putting them into play, mostly grappling, which is what I enjoyed the most, but also some punching and kicking. Before we knew it, dusk was upon us. That was just as well, I supposed. Vigo had worn me out. I was fit for manual labor, but I hadn't done resistance training for years. Of course, I didn't have anywhere close to Vigo's lasting power. He could have continued all night. Although evening had fallen, we still had some time left before Lee arrived back home. Vigo strolled over to the wooden shelter, gripped its roof, and, in one fluid motion that caused every muscle in his back and arms to flex, he lifted himself onto it. He glanced down at me. "Want to come up here? The view's pretty good." "Heck yes." I wasn't tall enough to reach the top of the roof, so Vigo offered a hand and helped me up. We sat down facing the wilderness, our legs dangling over the edge. The mountains glowed orange in the evening light, enhancing their raw beauty to something of fantasy. I had gained a new appreciation for why Vigo wanted to live up here. The view alone was worth the absence of electricity. "Thanks for that," I said to him, leaning back, my eyes ahead.
"Welcome."
A span of silence fell between us, but it was not uncomfortable. I glanced over my shoulder toward Vigo's second view, the city. My eyes traced the shape of the river, and that of the buildings extended around it. They melded together, forming one giant crescent around the palace. Then I asked a question that had been nagging me for a long time. "What is the actual meaning of your crescent symbol?" Vigo followed my gaze and joined me in eyeing the city.
"It symbolizes strength and potential, growth, like the waxing moon."
"Ah," I said softly. "That makes sense." It was ironic that it was Patris's crescent mark that Matris authorities stamped on boys who failed the test, when Patris was the last place they'd ever be allowed to go. I turned my thoughts to the symbol of the Matris flag, a curved grain of wheat. It was fairly self-explanatory. It signified growth and fertility.
but it was intended more to be an ode to a society rooted in pragmatism, diligence, and most importantly, peace. I sensed Vigo watching me as I gazed upon the city, but I didn't let on. I felt that strange flurry in my chest again. He seemed to hesitate, then asked, "How did you and Lee meet, Violet?" I realized that this was the first time I'd heard Vigo use Lee's first name. "I thought he told you," I said, my jaw tightening.
"Yeah," he said. "He did mention it in passing, I guess. Never mind."
I let him fade into quiet. The less we discussed Lee and me, the better. But since he posed a question about my relationship, it seemed only natural that I should turn a question on him that ran along the same lines. "Have you always been single?"
"No, I haven't. I was married, but things didn't work out."
I sensed the discomfort in his voice and immediately regretted asking the question. I didn't want to dredge all those painful memories up for him. Not on such a beautiful evening as this, when his mood appeared to be lighter than it had been since I'd met him. "I'm sorry," I said, and glanced away, hoping to make it clear that I didn't expect him to offer anything more on the subject. My eyes traveled further over the city of Patras to its vast surrounding suburbs, then northward, where the green began on Patras's side of the river, extending like an infinite ocean of trees, then to the river itself, whose hanging mist was tinged with the evening sun. And beyond that, blurred by the fog, the faint outline of Matris. Sitting here with Vigo, it felt somewhat painful to stare in my homeland's direction for long. I'd had enough of the cityscape anyway. I twisted back around and faced the wilderness. Vigo did the same. Only a quarter of the sun was visible now above the peaks. Soon, we would have to leave. I didn't want Lee getting tense with me again, under more suspicion that I was getting carried away. But we still had a few minutes left. Enveloped by the peaceful atmosphere on the cusp of light and darkness, a question bubbled up in me. "You ever wonder if things will always be like this?"
"What do you mean?"
Vigo asked, his voice husky. "Just how we find ourselves living." Vigo's gaze lowered to his hands. There was a pause before he replied,
"More often than I should probably admit."
Having both been victims of the law in our countries, I supposed we were more vulnerable to wondering. Grief did that to you. It made you wish for a life that wasn't yours. It made you dream. But dreaming wasn't encouraged in my world, just like expressing views opposing that of our queen wasn't. Doing the latter publicly was an offense that led to serious consequences, jail time, or occasionally even banishment. Criticism of the court was something that had to be done behind closed doors, with people whom you trusted wouldn't rat you out. I suspected Patris was similar in that respect, given Vigo's caginess to clarify certain comments he'd made about Patris's leadership. My eyes fixed on a family of eagles swooping down upon a rocky cliffside, settling in for the night.
"Do you feel like you belong in Patris?"
I asked him in almost a whisper. Vigo furrowed his brows.
"I suppose I don't really understand the question. I was born and raised here. I am a man."
I didn't really understand the question either. I'd been born and raised in Matris. I was a woman. Matris was where I belonged. Matris was my home.
"I guess I just wonder what happens to someone who doesn't feel they belong on either side of the river."
Vigo didn't have an answer to that one. Chapter 25. We didn't stay much longer on the roof. Vigo pushed himself off, landing on the grass, and I was about to jump off after him when he reached up to help me. I hesitated, unsure of how this was going to work. Holding his hands at this angle would be silly.
"Hold my shoulders," he said.
His hands positioned on the roof on either side of my hips. He beckoned me closer with a gentle nod. I leaned down to grip his shoulders. As I slid into his arms, his hands engulfed my waist. Warmth flooded through me, my feet touching the ground. I was suddenly acutely aware of my erratic heartbeat. I withdrew my hands from Vigo's shoulders, and he let go of my waist. But we shared the same 2 feet of soil for a few seconds, his eyes reflecting the fading evening light. Then I staggered backward. I looked toward the cabin, feeling lightheaded.
What's gotten into me?
It's this mountain air or something.
Let's go, Vigo said. His voice came as a croak.
He left me and strode toward the front of his home. I found my balance and followed him. Mounting the motorcycle, neither of us spoke as we traveled back to Lee's house. We arrived well on time. Lee had only just gotten in, and he smiled on opening the door to me, before the two of us waved Vigo goodnight.
Any change of schedule for him?
No press release has been made yet involving a date, Lee asked as soon as we were inside. It'll be kind of a last-minute fight, I said, my throat feeling parched. It's been fixed for Saturday.
Okay, Lee said, stroking his chin.
That gives us 4 days before the banquet.
I don't see why his schedule would change much immediately after the fight. Everything should still run as planned.
The next few days passed quickly. Almost too quickly. Except for Lee reporting a scare in the lab, where he'd witnessed a group of men huddled around the egg, evidently trying to coax it open. Nothing very eventful happened. Lee assured me that they'd failed to open it, though for all we knew, they might be getting closer to figuring it out. It was a good thing the banquet would soon be upon us. Lee continued to drop me off with Vigo in the mornings, and when he and I weren't in his office roaming the city or in some meeting, Vigo would be in the gym. I watched from the bench while Vigo worked out, sometimes by himself and sometimes with others. The two of us didn't go up to his cabin again. I had no more special jobs to accomplish for the mission. My next and final task would be on the night of the banquet, the night I was due to leave Patras. Lee's own prep work was almost done, according to him. It was no wonder that he had been so busy. He not only had to keep up with the demands of his job in the lab, but on top of that, fulfill his end of the deal for Matrix. He had a lot of weight on his shoulders. We both did. I regretted resenting him for not taking on as much danger as me. Although my tasks might be more out in the open and carrying more immediate risks, he was still working hard in the background. I didn't ask Lee for details about his own work, though. I didn't want to know his business, and I was glad that he didn't offer the information. I was also glad that he didn't make any more advances toward me, though I still felt an undercurrent of awkwardness around him. I was relieved when Saturday came around, the day of Vigo's fight. It marked a milestone, only 4 days left to go. Although Lee was at home, and in Vigo's eyes there was no reason for me to hang around with him, Lee suggested that going to his fight would be helpful. I'd seen Vigo regularly up until now, and I needed to keep the momentum going for the last few days. The fight was due to take place at night, and since Vigo had a number of other things to do before then, PFL formalities like final weigh-ins and such, he didn't come to pick me up until the evening. The fight was to be held in the same stadium as the Rosen-Cruz fight. I could only imagine how crowded it would be. As I hopped on Vigo's motorbike and we headed down the mountains, Vigo confirmed that we should expect a lot of people. The tickets had sold out in record time, spurring the PFL to set up screens around the outer walls of the arena so that people could watch from the square and bordering streets. Although the PFL had agreed not to broadcast the fight on television or radio, broadcasting it to extra people outside the stadium was apparently something that they could get away with in the contract. Something told me that I was feeling more nervous than Vigo for the fight, as we rode around the building to a back entrance. He looked calm and collected as ever as we entered the building. His confidence was something that I admired. He wasn't cocky or arrogant, but pragmatic. He simply knew what he was capable of. A man in a suit was there to greet us at the end of the entrance hallway. He introduced himself as Mr. Doherty, co-founder of the PFL. He shook hands with Vigo before leading us to a changing room, certainly a step up from Vigo's previous room. It was more than twice the size, everything more luxurious, from the front of the door engraved with his name in gold letters, to the soft, fluffy towels, to the air conditioning, to the tray of refreshments waiting on a table. My eyes lingered on the padded, fingerless gloves hanging from a hook by the door. Vigo nodded briefly in appreciation before Mr. Doherty left us alone. I wandered about the room and approached the frosted window. I opened it just a little to gaze outside at the crowds already forming. Vigo dumped his bag down and fished out his fighting shorts, also a step up from his previous fights. These were black and gold trim, sporting the bold letters PFL. Vigo headed to the ensuite bathroom to shower and change. When he emerged wearing the shorts, he removed the gloves from the hook and sat down next to me on the bench. I watched as he strapped them on. Finally, some decent protection for his knuckles. "Those look good," I commented. He flexed his fingers in the gloves. "Yeah." He stood up and began swinging air punches. "PFL makes a huge fuss about everything," Vigo muttered as he continued to warm himself up. "There must have been over 50 journalists at the weigh-in. My picture will be everywhere tomorrow," he scowled. "Then there's all the trash you're expected to talk about the opponent. Can't stand hype." "Well, you don't have to play along," I said to him. "You can do whatever you want. You're Vigo Croft, remember?" He scoffed. "What happens after you win this fight?" I asked. I was confident that he would win. It seemed silly to use the word if. "Then I suppose I will wait a week or so to see what the aftermath is like. If the buzz is somewhat bearable, I guess I'll sign up for a second fight. If it's intolerable, I won't." Someone knocked on the door. Some guy in black PFL uniform. One of the event organizers. "A gentleman from the Sportster would like to have a few words with you in the final lead up to the fight," he said. "Would you be willing to talk to him?" Vigo's expression darkened. "Is that the same guy who brought Miriam up earlier?" he asked. Yes. Then you can show him the exit." The organizer looked disappointed, but didn't press. He backed out of the room. "Miriam." "Who's Miriam?" I asked, hoping he wouldn't mind the question. Vigo turned his back on me, busying himself in his locker. "My late wife." I regretted asking. We both went quiet. Another interruption came barely 5 minutes later. As Vigo opened the door, it was another man in black PFL uniform, blonde with a scratchy beard and holding a clipboard. "Sir," he said, his eyes passing me as they swept around the room. "You need to come to meet Cruz now. The referee needs to have his final word with the two of you together." "Okay," Vigo sighed. He glanced back at me, indicating that I follow, but as I headed with him to the door, the employee objected. "I'm very sorry, Mr. Croft," he said, "but if your female friend could wait here in your changing room." Vigo's jaw twitched in annoyance. Then he exhaled. "Okay, Violet, wait here. Don't go anywhere." "I won't," I assured him. He left the room with the man, shutting the door none too gently behind him. I roamed around the room a second time, stooping to pick up a bottle of chilled water from the refreshment basket. Then I approached the window again and peered through the crack. We were on the ground floor, so I couldn't see the full extent of the crowd, but it had ballooned since the last time I'd looked out just a few minutes ago. After finishing my water, I needed the bathroom. I locked myself inside and realized I'd been sweating in spite of the air conditioning. It was the buzzing stadium, being surrounded by crowds of people.
The atmosphere wrought with tension and excitement. But the second I stepped out of the bathroom, a heavy fist flew at me from nowhere and caught me square in the face. I reeled, pain searing through my nose. Stars circled before my eyes. Before I could attempt to defend myself, a heavy weight was flung at me, knocking me from my feet and pinning me face down against the floor. As I tried to yell, a hand clamped around my mouth, and then a second hand, lined with some kind of pungent-smelling tissue, folded around my nose. My brain became foggy. I could no longer struggle. And then, all went black. Chapter 26. I woke up to a splitting headache and a coppery taste in my mouth. Blood. My own blood. I was lying flat on my back, the floor hard and rough beneath me. And cold. Terribly cold. Prying my eyelids open, I sat upright. Metal clanked and I realized that my wrists and ankles were fastened with chains. Chains that were fixed to the wall behind me. Immovable. No matter how hard I strained against them. And my clothes were ripped. My hair a matted mess. I sat in a small windowless room whose walls and floor were stone. The only light emanated from a dim gas lantern on the floor. Where am I? My heart pounding, I fixed my eyes on the opposite wall where jagged words had been scrawled in red paint. Welcome to Porticue. I stopped breathing. Attached to the wall beneath the words were photographs? I squinted in the gloom. Each depicted a woman, curled up in a fetal position on a floor that looked very much like the one I was currently sitting on. Behind, and looming over her, was a man. His body was cut off at the waist, so all I could see were his legs and heavy boots. Just as every woman was different, so appeared to be every man, different leg heights and shoe sizes. Then, as my eyes fell to the lowest photograph on the wall, I recognized the clothes the girl was wearing. That girl was me. What is this? Before I could consider yelling, I heard footsteps. The heavy wooden door opened, and in stepped a man whom I'd seen before. He wore different clothes, unkempt, Porticue-style clothing, but I recognized that scratchy beard. It was the PFL attendant who had taken Vigo away and insisted that I stay behind in the changing room. A second man entered behind him. He had a tattoo beneath his right eye. I recognized him, too. He was the man who had seen me take down his friend in the road, the man who'd gotten away. They moved toward me, their leering eyes raking me over. Arriving in front of me, the tattooed man lowered and grabbed my throat. I attempted to fight him off, but there was only so much I could do while my hands and feet were bound. I'd never felt more vulnerable and powerless in my life. He tilted my head upward and gestured to a shadowy corner in the room that I had not paid much attention until now. Fixed to the wall was a camera pointed directly at me. They had been watching me. "What do you want?" I breathed. The men seemed to be deliberately keeping their backs to the camera. "First," the tattooed man replied, his voice as scratchy as his companion's beard, "to teach you your place." His right hand balled into a fist. Gripping my hair with his left hand, he dealt me a crushing blow in the gut. Once, twice, thrice. Winded, I coughed and sputtered, clutching at my sides. I collapsed as he kicked me in the kidney, curling myself up into as tight a ball as I could. "Ada!" the second man shouted, his voice resounding in the chamber. I dared glance up as more footsteps echoed. A short woman entered the room. She was bone-thin, with lanky, mousy brown hair. I didn't think that she was any older than 25, yet she had deep lines around her mouth and forehead. Beneath her right eye, she too sported a triangular tattoo. The moment she laid her dark eyes on me, she lurched forward, her fingers dug against my scalp and ripped at my hair, forcing me into an upright position. She bent down to my level and spat in my face. You know that it was my husband you took down, she hissed.
I tried to protect myself as she dealt me a stinging slap across the face. Her thinness was deceiving. She had muscles in those arms. She struck me again and again, her bony fingers like whips against my skin. Then, reaching for a belt around her waist, she clasped at a handle and drew out a knife. Holding the back of my head, she pulled me closer to her. Stop! I wheezed. She ran the tip of the blade against my upper cheek, beneath my right eye socket, in one sweeping crescent motion. I cried out again, tears leaking from my eyes. Stop! I rasped. Stop it! She came at me again with the knife, but before she could make a second contact with the blade, one of the men gripped her by the arm and snatched the weapon from her hand.
Enough, he said gruffly. We don't want her so cut up just yet.
Ada, eyes still glimmering with rage, grabbed my neck and forced my head downward, toward the feet of the tattooed man. She squashed my face against his boots, their grime soiling my skin.
Know your place before a man, she hissed.
She held me there for 5 seconds before releasing me and stepping backward. I pressed my back against the wall in a feeble attempt to distance myself from the men I was left with.
The second reason you are here, the tattooed man went on,
as if there had been no interruption,
is to assist us in sending a message to any other bitches like you who have managed to leech their way into Patris.
He moved to me and, holding my hair, panned my head to the camera again.
Say hello, he whispered,
his mouth inches from my ear. He snickered, reaching into his pocket and drawing out a strip of brown fabric with 2 holes gouged into it. His male companion produced the same, and so did Ada. They tied them around their heads so that the upper halves of their faces were obscured but for their eyes. 2 men entered the room, both of them sporting similar masks, and one of them carrying a hot iron bar. The man carrying the bar handed it to Ada. She waved it around before my face, taunting me with it, bringing it closer until its heat caused my skin to break out in a heavy sweat. She gathered a strand of my hair and trailed it over the hot iron, singeing it and producing a sickening burning smell. She waved the frayed ends of my hair before my face, pressing them to my nostrils.
Imagine what your skin will smell like.
She grabbed my arm and extended it before glancing at the camera. An oily smile glided across her face as she addressed the lens.
This is for every woman out there who thinks it's okay to shout back at her man.
She lowered the iron bar against my sensitive inner wrist. My skin exploded in agony. A screech erupted from my throat. I was sure that I would pass out. Still eyeing the camera, the woman went on.
For every woman who thinks she can cheat or talk behind his back.
Another strike of the iron bar, a few inches further up my arm. Somehow, it was even worse this time, knowing what was coming. Tears spilled from my eyes as I struggled to break away from her grasp. Still, she went on addressing the camera.
For every woman who thinks she knows better!
Another burn, climbing up my shoulder. My entire body, drenched in sweat, had begun to shake uncontrollably.
And this,
she said in a lower voice, a terrifying sense of finality to her tone,
is for every bitch who thinks she's equal.
I was sure that the madwoman was going to strike me in the chest, maybe even drive the sharp end of the rod through my heart. So it came as a surprise when she stalled, and instead placed the rod down on the floor. The runaway criminal standing behind Ada gave me a knowing smile, relishing my fear.
Bastard, I saw your cowardly ass run away from me back on that street.
He bent down to my level, and I flinched as his hand gripped the side of my face, his calloused thumb touching my cheek.
It's a shame, he said. Look at you, young, blessed with good looks, a nice body. We don't treat all female visitors to Portacue like this, you know. Some of them
We even make wives out of, like Ada. We found her at 16.
Why are you telling me this? I croaked.
He sighed.
I'm not telling you as much as I'm telling the women who will watch this.
He let go of my face and rose to his feet. He addressed his companions surrounding us.
Bring in the table.
One of the men exited and returned a few seconds later, pushing along a rickety steel table on wheels. It had wrist and ankle holds attached to either end of it. Ada manifested a key and freed me from my current chains one at a time. I immediately leaped for the door, but it was a hopeless endeavor. My captors crowded around me, wrestling me into submission. They dragged me to the table where they strapped me down. These restraints were tighter, and it felt like they stopped the blood flowing to my feet and hands. Maybe that was the idea. As they gathered around me, the runaway man spoke.
Cut her!
I writhed as they reached into their belts and withdrew knives. They used the steel edges of the table to sharpen the blades, Ada on my right even gouging me in the thigh as she did so, deliberately careless.
These people are insane. Stop! I begged. Please! I'll do anything! Just stop!
That I had resorted to begging these animals cut me to the core, deeper than any knife could. It felt like renouncing any semblance of dignity I had left. These people needed to be lined up and shot. If only I had a gun, Ms. Dale's last-minute training would have actually been useful.
How do you want to do this?
Ada asked the runaway. They appeared to have finished sharpening their knives. The runaway, standing closest to my head, replied,
"Same as the last."
His answer brought a dozen nightmarish visions to my mind. As their knives descended on me, all I could do was close my eyes and pray. I thought of Vigo, about the chance I'd never have to see him again, and about the mission and my lost opportunity to reunite with Tim. As the blades began to press into me, piercing skin, a man yelled outside,
"Evacuate!"
The door burst open, and in stepped another man, face shining with sweat, eyes alight with alarm.
"Wardens!"
he panted. The word sent relief rolling through my body.
"What?"
the runaway man yelled back.
"Impossible! They can't have reached us so quickly!" "They're here!"
he insisted. Ada and the men surrounding me swore. Shoving their knives back in their belts, they loosened me from the table before grabbing hold of me. The tallest man, the runaway, hauled me over his shoulder, dangling me upside down, while a second man grabbed my wrists and held them tightly together. That didn't stop me from thrashing my legs. As they carried me out of the dank room and up a flight of grimy stairs, the man holding my wrists connected his knee with my face, sending my head into another tailspin. I could no longer keep track of where we were going or who was around me. All I knew was that their route was dark and bumpy, and then the air suddenly became a lot colder. A chill wind caused my skin to break out in goosebumps. We were outside. I caught the glare of headlights to our right and a loud roaring noise in the distance. Then came gunshots. We reached some kind of vehicle, and I was shoved into a spacious trunk and locked inside. I had no idea how much time had passed since I had been kidnapped, but the man had said that the warden's arrival was quick. I had no idea how the wardens had managed to locate me so quickly, given that Porticue was supposed to be tucked away in the depths of the mountains, somewhere even Vigo seemed hesitant to enter. I was rolled from side to side as the vehicle picked up speed, in spite of the hard bumps in whatever road or track we were following. I tried to grab hold of something to avoid more injury, but soon we were traveling so fast, the bumps so wild, it was impossible to avoid getting banged about.
What's going on? Where are they taking me?
The ground tilted in a slope. I rolled to the other side of the trunk. My stomach dropped. We were going downhill. Fast. The gunshots grew louder behind us. The base of the vehicle vibrated. Then we shuddered to a stop that sent the back of my head smashing against the trunk's side wall. The truck bobbed as people climbed out, unloading it of weight. And then the trunk opened. Two hands shot inside and grabbed me, yanking me out, and my feet sank into shallow water.
We were in the dip of a wooded area, and as I gazed around wildly, I noticed we were surrounded by a crowd of men, and one woman, and five trucks. I gazed up at the slope we had just descended. Its steepness made me feel nauseated. The gunshots echoing down came from somewhere near the top. The man, whom I realized was the same coward who had run away, tugged on me, pulling me through the water as everyone else began to cross the stream. I wouldn't let them drag me further. The man must have thought that I was too weak to put up much of a fight now. My nose had started bleeding again, and my brain was clouded, but desperation had a way of making you find strength you thought you'd lost. I dropped all of my weight downward, my backside hitting the rocky bed of the stream. My wrist slipped from the man's grasp, and I lurched for his knees, toppling him backward into the water. As he landed, his right hand instantly moved to his knife, but I had already predicted that. I slid the blade out of its sheath and, without a second's hesitation, slashed his throat in a fit of fury. His blood drenched my hands and arms and flowed around me as I fought to stand up, only to be instantly struck by a vicious blow to the back of my head. The jolt caused my grip around the knife to slacken, and it flew from my hands as I tripped. The upper half of me fell on land, but my legs and feet still trailed in the water. I cried out as a foot stamped down on my back, then hands gripped my neck, fingers gouging into my throat. With whatever renewed energy I'd managed to summon rapidly ebbing away, I fumbled around on the ground searching for a sharp rock. Discovering a stone that felt jagged enough to cut skin, I raised my arms and pressed down against the man's hands with one palm, while using the other hand to rip sharply with the pointed tip of the stone where I estimated his wrist was. Wherever I'd managed to strike, it worked. His hold on me loosened enough for me to gasp for air. I twisted myself around, only to see my latest attacker joined by five other men. They weren't going to mess around this time. They knew it. I knew it. The deprivation of oxygen had made me too weak to stand up anymore. I couldn't even attempt to continue defending myself. As the closest man leaped for me, all I could think to do was curl myself up in a ball, as if that would somehow soften the pain of impact. His full weight crashed down on me, knocking my head back. But I did not feel the tip of the knife or slash of the blade. No. All I felt was his crushing weight. I managed to slither out from beneath him and glanced up to see the other men had stopped in their tracks. Not just stopped, but they were beginning to scatter, racing across the stream and into the woods on the other side. That was when I realized why the man on top of me had become so motionless. As I slid out from under him completely, his face thunked against the ground. At the back of his head was a round, bloody bullet hole. I scrambled backward and tried to stand up, but I felt too dizzy. When I looked toward the slope where the bullet must have come from, my eyes found a tall figure running toward me through the trees. With the silhouette of a long gun in his right hand, his outline was familiar, even in the darkness. Wavy hair, the straight shape of a trench coat. I almost cried out in relief as Vigo's face emerged, illuminated by soft shafts of moonlight. His eyes gleamed with anxiety as he took in my bloodied state. "Whose blood is that?" he uttered in a strained whisper. I looked toward the stream and pointed to the corpse of the man whose throat I'd torn open. Then I spotted the knife, still coated with blood. It had fallen on the ground, not far away. Shouts of wardens drifted down from the slope. Vigo cursed. Throwing a sharp glance in their direction, he hurried into the stream and dragged the corpse out. Then he scooped up the knife. Wrapping his hands around its handle, to my shock, he drove it back into the dead man's throat. Leaving the blade erect, he leaped toward me, slipping one strong arm beneath my knees, the other wrapping around my waist. Then he picked me up and began to run with me. But not in the direction I'd expected him to. Not back up the slope he'd come from. Instead, confusingly, he dashed across the stream and reached the opposite side. Shooting another look over his shoulder toward his rapidly approaching colleagues, he hurtled into the woods with me.
The same woods the Porticue men were escaping into. The same woods the wardens were firing bullets toward. One hissed past us now, frighteningly close.
Vigo,
I panted.
What?
Don't talk,
he breathed, his eyes trained ahead of us. I clung to him more tightly as the slope on this side